What's up, everyone? This is Dariusz Kalbarczyk, co-founder of NG Poland, JF Poland, Quick Poland, AngularMaster.dev, and WorkshopFest.dev. Welcome back to the Angular Master Podcast. Today, we've got a special guest from Laren, Belgium, passionate developer who builds, teaches, writes, and speaks about Angular. Ladies and gentlemen, Brecht Bietz. Hi Brecht, how are you?
I'm very good. Thank you very much. How are you?
Thank you. I'm great. For those who don't know you yet, please tell us about yourself.
So I'm Brecht. I'm a software developer. I used to do AngularJS, started giving training in AngularJS. Then Angular 2, which was the name at the time, happened, and started giving training in that technology as well. I traveled the world. And I think now it's been like 6 years and a half of I've traveled the world doing training, coaching, and I think I've been in more than like 100 projects. So yeah, that's what I'm doing. I'm 4/5 of my time I'm freelancing. The other like other 3/5 of my time, I'm writing blogs. I'm giving training, coaching, helping companies kickstart projects and stuff like that.
How did your adventure in programming begin?
Yeah, that's a fun question. I always struggled a bit as a kid. I had ADHD. I was always a rascal. I did always stuff I shouldn't be doing. And every year I went to school, I did something else. Like I did electricity, mechanics. I've been a butcher. I've worked in 10 different factories. And then a friend of mine also worked at that factory and wanted to go back to school, and he did IT. And I followed them just because I had no direction whatsoever. And I basically fell in love with programming. I think I already started programming at the age of like 15, 16, building my first websites and stuff like that, but not professionally, of course. And after I finished school, I started doing, it was basically everything. I did Photoshop, but also JavaScript, Java, .NET. Everything. After a while, I was always pushed to the front end. Like every time I was doing .NET consultancy, they made me do all that JavaScript stuff that nobody wanted to do at the time, because you were talking IE5, IE6 was the browser that we were have to do compatibility for. And yeah, so I started doing more JavaScript, and I followed a course from John Papa on Pluralsight about single page applications. And I basically fell in love with it. And I was coding like 40 hours a week for my boss at the time, and another 30, 40 hours just at my pet project. And yeah, so never stopped doing that. I don't do .NET or any backend anymore. I do some Node.js, but I'm only doing front ends, and it grew gradually.
So why did you choose Angular?
Yeah, so Angular, it wasn't really a choice because, like I said, I was doing .NET and AngularJS. So I was used to TypeScript or like having typings, having dependency injection, and AngularJS had all that. And then in Angular 2, it became even better, right? Because you had TypeScript out of the box. You had the whole dependency injection. It looked so much like a .NET or Java application. Yeah, React was very early age back then. And I also liked doing React, but Angular seemed like the next step to do at the moment.
As Angular mentor since its beta stage, how have you seen the framework evolve over the years? And what do you think has contributed to its success?
So that's a very interesting question. So for me, the biggest contribution to Angular, its success, is that it's so opinionated. It's so attractive for Java and .NET developers. In Belgium, specifically, most of the big software platforms have a .NET or Java backend. And it's not always easy to find front-end developers, so they're looking for full stack. And when you have these concepts like classes and decorators and dependency injection and all that kind of stuff, it feels very similar to the backend technologies. And I used to be a backend developer. I used to be a .NET developer, and I really love the fact that it's completely typed. It's so opinionated. You have the CLI pushing you in this specific direction. I think it also put RxJS on the map, and I'm a really huge RxJS fan. I think Angular had some phases where people were thinking like, let's move to React or whatever. But I think that most of the actual software developers that started doing Angular are still doing Angular at this time. So I think the biggest success there is that it's very opinionated. It pushes you in a direction. When you're doing like a React project, for instance, you can do it like a million ways. When you're doing Angular, you can still do it wrong, right? But it pushes you really into this direction of object-oriented programming, of dependency injection, separation of concerns, and so on.
You provided training and coaching to developers. What are the most common challenges or misconceptions you've encountered when teaching Angular best practices?
Yeah, so the first thing would be component communication. And here I'm really talking about the keep it simple, stupid versus dry principle. So in school, they always teach you to be dry. Right. You can never repeat yourself. Repeating yourself is very bad. And I think keep it simple, stupid is more important. I think when you don't repeat yourself, you should not repeat logic. But if you repeat code, and because of that repetition, your code becomes way clearer, you can separate everything. It makes sense. So I'm talking about the whole smart and dumb component thing, like passing data from inputs to inputs, like from the top component to the child component and so on. I see people struggling with that. They're always trying to inject everything or add everything into this service and inject this in the lowest child component just so they could access the data. But then they're breaking unidirectional data flow and so on. So that's kind of dangerous. I've also seen a lot of things regarding state management. That's a very big topic out there. But one of the things that I really try to advise developers is like keep the state as low as possible in your component tree. Don't like create this one huge thing where you put all the state in there that maybe shouldn't even be managed. So sometimes people get lost in that and they wind up with this huge store where they put everything in. And RxJS. And the thing, RxJS is, it's complex, right? I've trained over 300, 400 people using RxJS, and I have to admit, I still struggle with it. I still struggle with my RxJS code that I've written 6 months ago, or code that is written by a colleague or whatever, or just maybe two weeks ago, me. It's something that is quite complex, and I know how it works, and I really love it, and I love to think reactive and stuff like that. But I think that's one of the hardest challenges that Angular developers face, like how do we communicate between components? How do we manage state, and how do we handle this cool but complex thing called RxJS? Because sometimes with RxJS, it feels like we're killing a fly with a bazooka. You have so much power, right? And with big power comes big responsibility, right? That's Uncle Ben from Spider-Man.
With your expertise in performance, scalability, and pragmatism, what would be your top tips for companies looking to optimize their large-scale web projects using Angular?
I would definitely advise everyone to use NX. even if you're creating this small pet project where you maybe want to manage a meal plan or whatever at home, just I still use NX because it fixes everything for you. It fixes the TypeScript pop mappings for you. You have all these integrations with Storybook and so on. Plus, they really innovate. So even if you're not looking at a monorepo, I'd still advise people to use NX because their tooling is awesome. And it's not just Angular. You can throw any other framework in there that you like. Another thing that I want to talk about is like the reusable versus flexible balance. I think that's a very important topic because everybody is trying to create reusable code, and that's fine. But we don't necessarily want to make those components reusable, because the moment when you make them reusable, they will get reused by other developers. Like, maybe you don't want it to be reused. So I would always like to keep that balance between reusability and flexibility, because when you're making a component reusable, it's not flexible anymore. Let's say that you have a product component, for instance, and you have a web shop and an admin panel. That product component could be shared between the admin panel and the actual web shop. But if a PM later says, like, I also want to see the stock inside of that component, and as a developer, you add it, then out of a sudden, it's also added in the web shop where you don't want people to see the stock. So in that case, it could be a good idea to just, like, copy-paste it. If it doesn't hold that much complexity, copy-paste it and let it live on its own. That's flexibility. So It's always a balance. It's hard to find a balance between reusability and flexibility. So I always start with flexibility. And then when it has to be reused, you can make the decision. Like, do we want to give it a life on its own, or do we want to reuse it completely or make it parameterizable? And for performance, learning the difference between the inner zone and outer zone in Angular is something that is very important. A lot of people don't know what the inner and the outer zone is, but everybody is adding the onPush strategy on their components, but it's not so much about which components get detected for changes. It's more about how many times change detection is actually triggered. So if you would, for instance, have a timer that's running every 100 milliseconds to draw something in the canvas, for instance, and you're running that in the regular Angular zone, yeah, you're going to have change detection running on all your components every 100 milliseconds, and that's a performance bottleneck.
You're listening, Angular Master Podcast. Listen, code, repeat. Everything you need to know to become an Angular super developer.
By the way, what do you think about Angular's latest features?
I love where they're going, but I'm also a little bit concerned about the identity of Angular. So I love the standalone components. I've been using them since version 14. I love signals for state management. I've created this own thing called observable state, where I abstract the RxJS problems in. And I've started refactoring that to signals as well. It's awesome. There's a lot of cool things happening. But I'm just hoping that for the developers I was talking about, like the Java, the .NET developers, they don't wind up with a completely new framework. Like, I hope they still keep their current APIs. I know that they want to make RxJS optional in a way. And I think that's a good thing. But yeah, I'm a little bit skeptical if we aren't changing too much. But it's not an opinion, it's more of a concern.
How do you ensure efficient performance in Angular applications?
I would use the onPush strategy on all child components unless they have inputs that contain objects with a prototype. Like, for instance, if we pass a form control tune input. Not sure why you want to do that, but some developers do. That means that if something happens in that form control, the change detection of the component that is using on push will not get triggered. So I only try to use it on components that have immutable data structures. I don't use it on my smart components because, the parent components, because those parent components, they will be marked for check like all the time. So change detection will happen anyway. And the moment where they actually are doing an asynchronous call, then change detection will break. And then if we don't know how change detection works, people will use the change detector ref marked for check or even a set timeout. And your application gets filled with all these manual marked for checks. So I would be careful with the unpush. Like I said before, running things in the outer zone can be a major performance optimization. And always the track by thing. So I had to give a training a few years at a company here in Belgium. And at lunch break, they pulled me in this room and they said like, hey, do you have 5 minutes to look at our performance issue? They had this huge list. And when they started scrolling, like the browser just froze. And I said like, this is, you're using an NG4 for sure, right? But did you use a track by? And they didn't know what it was. So they just added like track by, which was one line, and their problem was solved. So if you always use a track by, even if you're just tracking by the index, it could help us avoid a lot of performance issues.
Can you discuss the importance of modularization in Angular and how it can help organize code?
First of all, modules and ng modules, I mean, it's the same thing, right? So we have ECMAScript modules and they're there to just organize your code. Ng modules will be gone or will be less used in the future, but we can still achieve the same thing with just JavaScript and the ES modules. I think it's important to keep your stuff inside of your library. Like if you're having components that you don't want to be reused, don't expose them. Like never expose them. Keep your barrel file of your library as small as possible. And now I'm talking about the barrel file of an NX project, but it could be the same for Angular, right? In that index.ts file, you only expose what you need. So if you have a lazy loaded module, you should only expose your lazy loaded module. So that's the only thing that you should expose. You should not expose like your services or your components. So keep it there, keep it in one single barrel file so that it's encapsulated within that module. It's all about scalability, code reuse, encapsulation, flexibility versus reusability. So definitely like working in a modular way will make refactoring a breeze. Like when I'm in a code base, like a workspace with 400, 500 projects in there in a monorepo, on a day-to-day basis, we're constantly moving things around. And it makes sense. And we shouldn't be scared of it because when you have a decent architecture and you just don't make everything reusable, doesn't mean that you don't have to write reusable code, but you don't make it reusable, you can just like move things around when it makes sense. For instance, if you have an address component and you want to reuse that address component in another feature in your code base, you could say, okay, I'm going to reuse it. So I'm just extracting it to yet a new UI library that is being consumed by both of these feature libs. So if you're following the NX guidelines, you can definitely come up with this architecture, which is very modular and where you can just like move things around all the time. But it has to make sense.
What are the benefits of using lazy loading in Angular applications and how can developers implement it?
Yeah, so the benefits are you will wind up with a smaller initial bundle size. That's one of the benefits. But the biggest benefit for me is that it forces you to think about this sandboxed environment, like your lazy loading a chunk. You're lazy loading a piece of your software, which could be a separate software if you're using module federation or whatever. It forces you to think about like this should be inside of this sandboxed environment there, and we can just lazy load it on demand. How to implement it is, yeah, it's basically being done for you if you're using NX, but with the new standalone components, it's just importing routes. So it's just importing an array of routes which will load a module. So basically it's done for us right out of the box. We don't have to, it's not complicated. It used to be complicated, like in Angular 2. I remember struggling with it, like when they introduced lazy loading, but right now it's just a breeze to do that. And if you're using NX, you can just add the --routing --lazy parameters on your CLI command, and everything will just work out of the box. I also believe that we should do it by default, like using the lazy loading. For me, everything is lazy loaded in my applications. Maybe if there's, for instance, a chat box that should be shown in different parts of the application, maybe then I wouldn't lazy load it, but normally I would definitely lazy load it.
How can Angular developers leverage the power of RxJS observables and manage application state and handle asynchronous tasks?
I really love this question. And it's a question that lies very dear to my heart because I had a lot of discussions. I met a lot of very interesting people where I could spar with these ideas. I started using frameworks like NGRX and stuff like that. But after a while, for me personally, my code base became really bloated with boilerplate, and it was very hard to see what was going on. And then I started to think, like, why can't we just use behavior subject? A behavior subject is basically a subject that replays the latest value and always has the initial value. So a behavior subject is the only subject in RxJS that has a dot value property where we can synchronously get the value from. Now, the thing about these behavior subjects is they tend to wander around in your code base. Like, you can have like a gazillion behavior subjects just lying around, and it can be hard as well. So for my current client, I started to develop this thing called observable state. And what my goal there was, it was to use the power of a behavior subject, but do it in an opinionated way, because that's what these frameworks are trying to do, right? They're trying to do this in an opinionated way where you don't have to worry about memory leaks, and you don't have to worry about multicasting in RxJS, and you don't have to worry about all these different things called schedulers and so on. And basically, we wind up with a 100-line code file that does everything for us. It you can connect observables to it. You can cherry pick different pieces of state. It's completely synchronous. You have a snapshot all the time, because when people are talking about RxJS, they're talking about you have to be reactive. You always have to do reactive programming. And I mean, it makes sense when your data flows to your component. But when you're trying to save a user, for instance, you want the current user. You do not want to subscribe to some observable and then use the take one operator to get the latest value. That doesn't make sense. You want the snapshot, right? So, and this is where we're going with signals as well. We want to go to synchronous states. It prepares us for signals. So the principles that you are doing by using that small piece of code that I'm not even going to open source in an NPM package, because I don't consider it a good practice to just install whatever you find. Own it yourself. It's 100 lines of code. It's not that much, and it will prepare you for signals, which is also synchronous state. So really love RxJS, but if I'm completely honest, it's complex. It's hard. There's so much you need to know. Like, to be completely honest, I hadn't heard about the queue scheduler till last month. And this is what the observable state needs, because a behavior subject that is updating state within its in that specific behavior subject, yeah, it can get wrong quite fast. And I think that's also the reason why these state management frameworks are very popular, because they try to hide all that complexity that RxJS has to offer you. Like I said, it's an awesome technology, but sometimes it feels like killing a fly with a bazooka. I mean, it makes way more sense to reason about state if it's synchronous and then still leverage RxJS to do like a deep bounce time or a switch map, something like that, that you cannot just do irregular promises. But for state, I think it's very nice that signals are coming and that it gets simplified a lot by that.
In what ways can Angular developers optimize change detection to improve application performance?
So change detection is a very important aspect in Angular right now. I was coaching a client of mine 6 months ago in change detection, and then I realized I actually didn't know change detection myself like I should have known it. And I started digging into it more and more and giving some training inside of that company, and I wound up writing a book about Angular change detection. So I had to actually reverse engineer the source code, because there is so little information on the web about what's actually happening behind the scenes. So how do we optimize performance with change detection? Get to know change detection. I actually have a 5-minute video on YouTube where I just explain everything you need to know about change detection in 5 minutes. Basically it will tell you like there are these two zones, and there's this one zone where every event that happens inside of that zone is constantly triggering change detection, and you have a zone that is built specifically to not trigger change detection. And then you can optimize change detection. For instance, if you have this drag and drop, right? The moment you start dragging, it's gonna fire mouse move events like 10 times a second. So if you're running that in the inner zone, you're gonna trigger change detection in the every 10 milliseconds. So what I'm trying to say there is, if we're doing a drag and drop, when we click, we need to trigger change detection, but when we move around, we don't need to trigger change detection, because we're redrawing with vanilla JS. And then when we release again, we need to trigger change detection again. So that means that we only trigger change detection twice instead of 100 times. So that kind of stuff is very interesting. You can also detach from the change detector. But in general, I would just be cautious when using third-party libraries. For instance, I had a colleague who installed a perfect scroll bar a few years ago in a project. And that perfect scroll bar was an NGX version of the perfect scroll bar. And they didn't really pay that much attention to performance. So every time we scrolled in our application, it was like firing change detection like 30 times a second. And the application became slow and nobody knew, because we just installed something that was like behind the scenes constantly triggering change detection. So I think when it comes to performance in Angular, change detection might be the biggest thing instead of the track by thing that we already mentioned. I would just say get to know it. Like the 5-minute video is very, very simplified. It's not rocket science. And just be aware of the inner zone, which is the default zone, which is constantly triggering change detection on every single event.
What is your YouTube channel name?
It's Simplified Courses. I only started recently. I think I have like five videos. I'm really struggling with time lately. I'm trying to do too much in way too little time. But so that video is something that I'm actually pretty proud of, because it's a very hard concept to summarize in 5 minutes. But yeah, if you just look at simplified courses on YouTube, you should be able to find it.
What are some useful tips for managing forms in Angular, and how can developers ensure better user experience with form validation?
To be honest, I've been struggling with forms since Angular 2. Well, actually since AngularJS, but also in Angular 2, I've always been struggling with forms. In every company I started, I had to implement some kind of form abstraction because there was so many redundancy. And then for some reason, like the community kept telling us, yeah, you have to use reactive forms. And after a while, you start believing it because, you know, reactive forms are easier to test. Right now, I use integration tests to test my forms, so that doesn't really matter anymore. But I saw an interesting talk about template-driven forms at ng-conf from Ward Bell, and then a new talk about how to do form validations in template-driven forms. I'm still working with reactive forms, but I'm making the switch. Already kind of made the switch in my mind, but I have not introduced it on big projects yet. But I can definitely, he will be able to explain it much better than I am. You just have to look at Ward Bell, the latest two talks. They're really nice. So what he actually does in the last talk is he doesn't treat a form as something that has to be validated, but there's a model behind that form. And that's the thing you want to validate, because you might want to validate that on the back end as well. And he uses this technology called FEST, where he creates these suites of assertions to validate against that model. And then he creates some kind of component or directive, I don't really remember, that just translates that test suite to your form. So there's zero boilerplate code. You don't have to look inside of your templates or forms like what is validated and how. You have this specific model for that. I thought it was very interesting. Definitely check it out. But yeah, so I've been struggling with forms since ever.
How can developers use Angular CLI effectively to streamline their development workflow?
That's a nice question. So when Angular 2 got released, there wasn't really a CLI. And then after a while, there was a CLI, but nobody used it. And then it was optional. And somehow, I don't know when it happened, but now everybody is using the CLI because we do not want to create our own webpack configuration for Angular. I've been doing that for years in AngularJS, actually, and in Angular, creating all these webpack configurations and then code coverage with Istanbul and all these different technologies that had to work together. The CLI just does that for you. I don't use the Angular CLI. I use NX, but basically NX uses the Angular CLI. And as my two cents, I would say as a best practice to always use commands to generate. Don't start to create or copy-paste code. Just create it with the CLI. Because if you do that, you will wind up with a way more consistent code base. Because your code will always be at the same place, you will have the same configurations, you will have the prefix, you will not forget the prefix of your component selector, and so on. Yeah, I would definitely do that. And when you're using NX, I would also configure the generators part in the NX.json. So the generators part, there you can put default configs for components, for directives, for services, and so on. So if you're saying like standalone true and you're generating a component, then it's going to be a standalone component. And when you have a code base where you do standalone components, you probably want all your components to be standalone if you have a new code base at least, or for new code. If you don't want to generate unit tests, but you rather want to test your components with Cypress, for instance, you put test to false. So once you configure those configuration parts in the generators part of NX, basically your commands become really short. And it's very nice to just create the stuff that you don't want to write yourself automatically.
Have you used ChatGPT to help develop an Angular application?
I have been playing with ChatGPT for a while. For coding, it's just basically my rubber duck. So I ask it some stuff and then it basically gives me an answer. It's not always right. But I really love the technology. I've written an article a few months ago where I actually wrote the snake game with ChatGPT. And it was actually a very pleasant experience because first I told him to write me snake and he gave me something really bad. Like, it didn't work at all. It was lacking all these features. And then I just told him, like, no, I want you to write me the most complete snake game there is. And he did. And I copy-pasted the code and it didn't work. And it didn't work because he forgot to add some imports there, some imports of dependencies. So I asked him, like, again, I'm getting this error. What's this? And he told me, like, you forgot to add an import. And I told him, like, I didn't forget anything. Like, you did. Is there anything else you forgot? And he actually forgot two more imports and he told me about it. Like, oh, yeah, I forgot two more imports. The game worked. It just worked. And I was very, very surprised. I said, like, okay, but you're putting all this code inside of this component. I mean, do you think that's a good idea architectural-wise? And told me, you know, could be better. Let's extract the game logic into a different service. And he did that, and that worked as well. And then I started to push him a little bit more, like, how do we optimize this for performance? And he was talking about animation frames and some other stuff I don't really remember. I told him, like, do you have anything change detection related, maybe? And then he told me to use the on-push strategy on my component, so it got better. And then the last step was the human step, where I actually run the entire snake game in the outer zone, because it was just a canvas that got redrawn every 100 milliseconds. So that was very nice. But I'm not using Copilot. I think I should. But there are so many things that I want to check, like the AutoGPT thing. I do think, like, the ChatGPT is going to be like a major, major revolution. And I don't think we should be worried about our jobs. I think we will just have to learn to use these AIs, and they will help us to create awesome code faster. And also, like, if you're asking something like, how, for instance, would you do content projection in Angular and how do you pass a template to that? Like, that stuff that you have to find in the documentation, it's nice to just ask it to the AI and see an instant, like, okay, let's try this. And to be fair, the results is not always correct. Sometimes it just tries to make you happy, but it doesn't work. But I mean, in a few years, it's gonna be a different landscape, I think.
What are the advantages of writing unit tests and end-to-end tests for Angular applications, and how can developers incorporate them into their projects?
I used to write unit tests for everything. And I mean, I'm not proud of it, but I was a person at a certain time in my career that wanted to have like this 100% test coverage thing, because maybe I'm a bit autistic. I don't know. It made me feel good in my mind. But it turned out that actually when writing unit tests for everything, I spent more time writing unit tests than writing the code. But it was not just that. I spent more time maintaining those unit tests and rewriting those unit tests. Every time a dependency got added or removed or replaced, I had to, like, everything was broken again. So we started rewriting those tests to actually make them pause. And if you're doing that for your own code, you remember what you were trying to do. But if somebody else has written those code and you constantly have to make other people their test pass, you might not see what their intention of that test was. And so you wind up with bad tests. I think it was like 3 years ago, I started freelancing for this company called Rosa. And they had introduced this thing called the honeycomb principle, which basically tells you write a little bit of unit tests, you write a lot of integration tests, and you write a little bit of end-to-end tests again. So for the end-to-end tests, you're testing the happy part. So when you deploy your application, like, can I still log in? Can I still book an appointment? Can I still do like these basic things? And when you're having these very complex algorithms or stuff that you would have tested TDD before, like first write your test and then start implementing the actual logic, we would still write unit tests for that. But for our components, we would write Cypress tests in combination with Storybook. So we use Storybook to sandbox the environment of the component, and then we write Cypress tests for that. I was very skeptical. I said, like, this will not work. I mean, I'm so used to writing these unit tests. Why would we do these Cypress tests? They're going to be slow. They're going to be slow to write. They're going to be slow to execute, and so on. And it turned out that that wasn't true at all. It was actually very fast to write them. It was slower to run than the unit test, but it was still way faster than an end-to-end test. But after a few months, I started forgetting about the time that I ever had to rewrite tests. I never had to rewrite tests again because I wasn't testing the implementation. I was testing if it actually worked. My tests became way smaller, and I could refactor a component to a React component, and it would still like test that component completely. So since then, I haven't looked back, actually. And now for my components, I always use Cypress in combination with Storybook. And if you have a smart component, then you have to think about what is the actual thing that I'm trying to test? What is this component doing? We're not going to talk about visualizing data because that's like the dumb components that it uses where you can test that completely. But like the orchestration part, we want to test some happy parts in there and the orchestration. And then in their dumb components, you want to sandbox that component again in a story and write Cypress tests on that as well. And to be honest, it works really, really well. I really love this approach. And I don't think there are a lot of developers out there that can actually say they love writing tests. I mean, it's something that we need to do, but we don't always want to do. And when you're spending more time writing your unit tests than actually coding, or more tests maintaining those, time maintaining those tests, yeah, then it becomes demotivating. So I would definitely watch out for that, because there's nothing worse than a developer that is not motivated anymore. And every company has their budget. Every company has their budget for features, and every company has their budget for tests, right? So make that budget count. If you can spend like 4 hours a day or 3 hours a day writing tests, make sure that these tests, they give you return of investments. And that's what this honeycomb principle really does, in my opinion.
Can you discuss the role of dependency injection in Angular and why it's considered a best practice?
So dependency injection in general, I think it's originated from unit tests, where we can just mock dependencies away. I think that's one of the first things why people started using dependency injection, and also to decouple stuff, right? So you don't need to know the dependencies of your dependencies when you're instantiating something. So that principle alone is kind of nice. I think it's clean. Especially when developing Angular applications, dependency injection is like the most awesome feature of the entire framework, in my opinion. And not the fact that you can just abstract things away, But if you're providing something in root, it becomes a singleton, right? You can have access in the entire application. But the cool thing is you can also use dependency injection on modules or components. And when that component where you provide a dependency to gets destroyed, you know, that dependency will get destroyed as well. So a lot of developers don't know that you can actually implement the ng on destroy lifecycle hook on an Angular injectable. And it's very powerful. For instance, let's say that we have this wizard with five steps. And in that wizard, so we have a wizard component. And that wizard component has a wizard state or a wizard's view model or whatever you want to call it. Like you have this wizard service. You could use that wizard service to communicate between all the different steps. These different steps are different routes with different components, and they all need that wizard service. So we can add state in that wizard service. There could be like, there's five steps. So let's say that there are five different form groups in that wizard service. When we go back from step four to step three, we will still have all the data because it's in a wizard service. And the moment we navigate away from that wizard, the wizard component gets destroyed. So its wizard service also gets destroyed. And we get that for free. We don't have to manage this. We don't have to invalidate that piece of state. So using dependency injection on components can be very powerful. Also, if you're thinking about redundancy, so let's say that we have a user detail and a user add component, and 90% of the code in there is the same. So we cannot just use any service and provide it in root, because then the user detail and user add will share state, and we don't want that. So we provide it on each of these two components, and we can just reuse, or we can extract logic inside of those injectables and use composition over inheritance to avoid redundancy, but we still have different instances that automatically get cleaned up for us. So I really love it. I love it for state management. I love it for communication between different components when there's like a router outlet between these components. I think it's the biggest feature Angular has to offer. And I think that's also why it's so attractive for backend developers like .NETers or Java developers.
How do Angular developers benefit from following a consistent coding style like the Angular Style Guide?
So I think the goal there is consistency. Guidelines are a matter of perception, right? So if I have a best practices training, and all of those best practices are personal experiences, there is no such thing as a good guideline or a good best practice. It's, of course, there are some of them that we cannot ignore, but basically it's something that we choose as a team. And I think it's important that in a company, the guidelines are being chosen by that team. It gives you the opportunity to debate with your colleagues. And what I usually do is I create this guidelines MD file and I just put it inside a repo. I don't mostly even use a different repo. I just put it inside the repo together with the code. And people can create pull requests for it. They're not gonna, so nobody can diverge from the guidelines unless they have a valid reason, but they're the owner of those guidelines. And when they're creating a pull request to update those guidelines, then the entire team should be able to say something about it. They can debate. And yeah, it's since it's so close to the code, it will probably get read too. Because if you're gonna add it to Confluence or whatever, you know, people rarely read the guidelines. And when you're in your IDE and you're thinking like, should I use an underscore prefix for a private variable or not? You can just go to the guidelines. Oh no, we don't do that, for instance, or we do, whatever. Because I think guidelines everybody has opinions, right? And ITers can be very biased, to say the least, and everybody is right, you know? But when you have a debate about it and you put it in the guidelines, you can let it go and you just follow the guidelines because it gives you consistency. And that's basically the most important thing, like having a consistent code base, because it's an ease of mind, and it just results in a better quality of code.
What are the key factors to consider when choosing tripartite libraries and tools for Angular projects?
That's another great question. I think every dependency that you install is like creating a tiny marriage. And it's the same with dependencies, because when you install them, especially when you install a dependency that has a dependency to a specific Angular version, you can get caught quite quickly. I would avoid to use these NGX kind of dependencies if you can, unless, you know, they're really battle tested. And, you know, like, for instance, I don't use NGRX myself, but I'm pretty confident that when they go to a new Angular version, NGRX is gonna move like right along with it. So it's not dangerous to add stuff like that, but there are so many NGX dependencies out there. So if you want to start with open source, and there is this thing, let's say Full Calendar, for instance. Full Calendar is a 12-year-old or 14-year-old, I think now, JavaScript library that just gives you the basic calendar that we all know. Let's say that you want to become an open source developer and you want to have quick traction, you just create your NGX Full Calendar and you just create a wrapper around that and you ship it and people start using it, and that's awesome. But that doesn't really mean that the quality of that wrapper library is that good. So I would always check GitHub stars. I would check the open issues. I would check how long it exists. I would check in the history how long it took to go to new Angular versions and so on. You could check the weekly downloads. But I'm not a fan of reinventing the wheel again, but sometimes it makes sense. Like, for instance, I'm working for DHL Aviation now, and one of their so the aviation part is the airplane business, right? And one of their core components is a table. They have to visualize so much data on one screen, and they have a lot of specific things there, like collapsible rows, reordering, stuff like that. And everything that you do in that table, they want to keep that as a state and they want to persist it on the backend and so on. It's crazy. So for that, we looked at different alternatives and we wind up writing it ourselves. And it took us like 2 weeks or something to write it ourselves. And now we own it. We own the quality, we own the testing, we own the features, we own the best practices, we own everything. And in some cases that makes sense. If you're creating your meal planner application, don't start writing your own table. Use whatever's out there, right? It really depends on what you're developing. But I would be cautious to not just install a dependency, because it can get tricky. I'm not gonna name any dependencies, but I had two kind of very well used and famous libraries, and I had problems with migrating to Angular 15.x because there was something that wasn't up to date. And then it makes you wonder, like, do you have any idea how much dependencies there are in my node modules folder? Like, how does that not break sooner? So I would just say, if you have to use it, of course, but always check the GitHub, always check the NPM weekly downloads. And, you know, what can also help is try it in StackBlitz. You know, just try that specific dependency in StackBlitz. I have had dependencies with a lot of stars that I couldn't even install in StackBlitz because, yeah, for some reason it broke. And then you know, maybe it's a good idea to look for an alternative that has more credibility.
What advice would you give to Angular developers who want to stay up to date with the latest best practices and trends in the Angular ecosystem?
So the first thing that I would do, and this is the cheapest thing that you can do, which will only take you like 10 minutes a day, is create a Twitter account. And you could follow the people that I follow. It's only like 230 people or something. And every single person that I follow has contributed to my knowledge in a way. And every day, just go to your feed and they will, it's basically a push mechanism, right? They will just push information in your head. I mean, you will know that there's this thing called signals that are coming, and you will know that there are functional components on the way, or that they're at least debating about that. So just get a Twitter account, follow the feeds daily, make a list of blogs. If you're a reader, if you're not a reader, you can go to YouTube channels to avoid the, like, tutorial hell. I've been working on this best practices training. I'm going to do it online, like live online, the 11th of May. But my plan is to create an actual product course for that as well. In the future, also give it on site. So, but basically, it's like 7 years of experience. You cannot experience. I mean, you need time for that. I've thrown it in this one thing. It will not help you keep up to date, of course, although it gets updated with the latest and greatest. So I think it's like 6 months old now, and I've been constantly updating it. There's this new chapter about signals coming soon. But we're not here to advertise my training. So I would say just Twitter is the cheapest thing. That's just super cheap, and people will not like post pictures of their spaghetti plates or whatever. They will like they will tell you interesting stuff. And then most of the time it's a link to a blog. If you like that blog, you can bookmark it or subscribe. And then most of the time you can just get mails about articles that can be interesting, and you don't have to start looking for interesting information. The information will come to you. And another thing that I would really advise for beginner people is create a pet project. Like, create something that you love. After my first divorce, yes, I've been divorced twice, but after my first divorce, I really had financial trouble. I wasn't working that long yet. I had to pay rent by myself. And so I created this application that visualizes where my money went. Like, how much do you pay on rent? How much do you pay on food? How much do you pay on going out and stuff like that? And that was the same time I followed the Jump Papa course from Pluralsight. So I could use all these awesome technologies. It used to be Knockout.js with Semi.js for routing. And then we had Amplify and stuff like the whole JavaScript fatigue. But it was awesome. I could like use this project to do something that helped me. I would advise not to think about making it payable, because when you're making it payable, you're creating this burden on your chest. And you have to start performing, and you're not a developer anymore, but you're a marketeer, you're a salesman, you have to wear all these different hats with all these different responsibilities, and the fun can get sucked out of your pet project quite fast. So own that pet project, feed it, add awesome features. If you see this new thing called signals, why don't you refactor one of your components to use the signals approach? You will have learned a lot. You will have a lot of questions that you can ask to the right people. So that's my two cents.
And now, it's time for the non-tech questions. Anything can happen here.
What kind of person is Brecht, and how do you see yourself?
the person I am is I try to help people. And the reason I knew that I tried to help people is I struggled a lot with love. I was at this bonfire and a friend told me, like, you don't look happy anymore. You should look up like this guy called Tony Robbins. And he's basically this self-taught guru that helps people achieve happiness. The thing about being happy is having a fulfilled life. That's art. Like having a beautiful girlfriend or money or whatever, there's a science to that, but being happy, that's really art. And by doing these notes that he told me to do in his seminars, the thing that makes me happy is helping people. And I think that's why I started giving training in AngularJS and Angular as well. But then COVID happened and then stuff got pretty blurry. But so I learned that, like, when I help people, it makes me happy. So it's a motivation to do that. So a few times a week, I also take time to help people. So just reach out. I help them for free, like developers that are struggling, because trainings aren't always cheap. And for some people, it's very hard to get that money. So I don't want to give them discounts. I'd rather just like coach them for free, you know, have an honest conversation, and we can just sparse. So I really love doing that with the limited time I have, of course. So yeah, that's basically who I am. I love to work out, but also because I need it mentally to work out. And for the rest, I love my job. I love coaching. I love training, and I love creating content. And the content part can get tricky sometimes, because sometimes it feels like there's a lot that is being expected of you. And the simplified courses thing is only like 6-7 months old, so the audience is pretty small. So it's sometimes hard to find motivation to write that content, because you don't always know when it's going to be read or seen. But basically, just trying to be me.
Do you have some hints for us regarding self-organization?
Yes. I do. So for me personally, I need to go to the gym like 4 times a week to have this mental health going on. For organization, in the beginning of the day, I always make a to-do list. I know like most people can just do that in their head. By just putting that to-do list there, it takes you 10 minutes, and there's not a single moment in that day where you say like, what should I work on now? Because you just take at that list, like, okay, I still have to do this. There's always enough on your list. There's always enough on your plate. And when you're having a productive day, when you're having a day that you said, like, today I really did a ton, that's the best motivation that you can have for the next day. I've been in projects where we have to wait for feature requests and stuff like that, and sometimes there was not that much work going on, and even though you still got paid, you just sat there like waiting for work. That's the worst thing that can happen for your motivation. So if you have that to-do list, even if there's not a lot of work, and your employer or your client comes to you and tells you like, hey, what you're working on, there's not much I can do there, but here I have this list where I looked at the performance of this specific component today, for instance. So always have that list.
What's about your work-life balance? Do you have some hints for us?
That's the most tricky thing you can ask, because I'm not only trying to be an engineer, I'm also trying to be this solopreneur. I'm still early stage in that thing, but it does take a lot of time already. So finding the balance is very hard. And one of the biggest pointers I can give is, if you're spending time with your family, spend time with your family. Like, ditch that phone. If you have dinner, sit on the table together, have a conversation, and don't be busy with work. And at the same time, when you're busy with work, you know, tell your children to not come bug you, because you lose your attention and then you're less productive. So I think the most important thing there is to really have this this separation of these two different things. Like, don't do two things at the same time, because you're not going to perform well in it. And if you're doing one thing at the same time, yeah, you can ace it. Your children are going to be way more happy. If they see you, they're going to be more fulfilled. You're going to be more fulfilled. Your next day is going to be more fulfilled. You're going to be more productive, and so on. And like I said, going to the gym, it's like, people think it costs you energy, but it actually gives you a lot of energy for free. What I also try to do in the morning, and that's maybe a silly comment, but I always turn the shower to like ice cold for like 1 minute or something. And it wakes me up, but it also prepares me for stuff I don't like to do, because I don't like to take a cold shower at all. But it gives you the attitude to say like, okay, I'm just gonna do that. If I'm doing this right now, then this annoying unit test that I still need to write, I'm just gonna do that and not gonna sob about it. So yeah, basically that. But still, to be honest, I'm still looking for answers to get work balance very good. To be honest, for me, it's sometimes easy as well, because my girlfriend does not live with me yet, and she also has two children. So when my children are in bed, I'm alone anyway, and I have time to write articles or create content. So yeah, in that case, I think I'm lucky, between quotes, but it's still a struggle.
A book you would recommend to our listeners?
So everybody can learn a skill, or everybody can become good at something, and tons of resources out there. But yeah, I would recommend the book The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, because it made an impact. It's not really learning something. It's like learning how to deal with situations and how to not get heated discussions if you're talking with a colleague, whether you should use Angular or React, you know, just letting the things go. But yeah, like books, I think there's so much awesome content out there. If you're interested, you can always have a look at the Change Detection Simplified ebook. But and there's no one single book. So if there's one single book that I would have to recommend, it wouldn't be a technical book, because there are so many technical books out there. And most of the time, the blog articles that you read are the same quality or even better than a technical book. It's not always the case, but there's so much content out there. So if you fix like the root cause, like not giving fucks about everything all the time, that can really help in everyone's career. And the thing is, it's a pleasant book to read. The guy, I think it's Mark Manson that wrote it, he's a very funny person. So it's a very easy read, and just makes you realize like, yeah, everything is possible. If you want to become like this expert in Angular, you can. I mean, it also covers imposter syndrome and stuff like that. So definitely an interesting read there. And for the rest, it's not a book, but what I really love to do is like on an evening like this, when the podcast is finished, like turn on YouTube and look up stuff, like even like Tony Robbins, for instance, where he just makes you think like everything that you want to achieve is possible. Like I didn't know that I wasn't going to be here in this podcast with you a few years back. I would say like, whoa, I'm very humbled that I can be here. But what I'm trying to say is like everything is possible. And maybe it's more important to focus on these skills, like seeing your full potential, being happy, than saying, yeah, I have to know every single framework. I have to be the best in this or the best in that. So if I would recommend a book, I don't think it would be a technical one.
Brecht, thank you. Thank you so much for this great episode.
Thank you.
Thank you so
much. Pleasure was mine.